We come now to our conversation with John Crowe Ransom. He has agreed to speak with us about some of the technical aspects of his own work, as well as that of others.
Lately, I've been examining my own poems. I never dared to study them until a year or two ago. But I don't mind. They're certainly not sacred to me. And I think, what I intended, but perhaps intended without knowing it, because when I wrote most of my poems, I was unconscious of the principles of poetic composition, unconscious of meters, didn't know what I was doing in an articulate sense. I imagine that's the rule with poets, that they go right ahead on their own intuition, and then later they wonder what they've done and look at it to see. I'll try a poem of mine, which happens to be the commonest one, the one most anthologized, I think. Bells for John Whiteside's Daughter. I remark that this is a domestic poem, and it's well within the prerogative of poetry, I imagine, and I suppose it has not been disputed that the domestic situation is, by long odds, the most important of all the human situations, and domestic problems must be solved if a man is going to be successful. And so this is a very domestic and homely situation. Perhaps I'd better read the poem and then comment it. I won't stop in the middle of it. Bells for John Whiteside's Daughter. There was such speed in her little body, and such lightness in her footfall. It is no wonder her brown steady astonishes us all. Her wars were bruited in our high window. We looked among orchard trees and beyond, where she took arms against her shadow, or harried under the pond the lazy geese, like a snow cloud dripping their snow on the green grass, tricking and stopping, sleepy and proud, who cried in goose, "Alas for the tireless heart within the little lady with rod that made them rise from their noon apple dreams and scuttle goose-fashion under the skies." But now go the bells, and we are ready. In one house we are sternly stopped to say we are vexed that her brown steady lying so primly propped. And now shall I explicate a little?
Please, please.
The little girl had tremendous energy. We looked out at her, this couple, probably the husband is the speaker in the poem, from their high apartment window, and saw her out there. What was she doing? We looked among orchard trees and beyond, where she took arms against her shadow. That implies that among the nation of children, this little girl is trying to be supreme. That she is, and here she's fighting with ghosts. She's trying to be Faust. And then when she undertakes to turn the geese to her own purposes, she's trying to be Tamerlane or Alexander the Great, or something like that, an ambition surpassing the strength of a little creature. Or harried under the pond, the lazy geese, like a snow cloud dripping their snow on the green grass, who cried in goose, "Alas for the tireless heart within the little lady with rod," and so on. That is to say that the usual, or a usual, trick, device, of the metaphysical style in poetry is the pathetic fallacy. And people may say, "Oh, that pathetic fallacy is absurd." Well, that one is, but others got into so gently and make such a mild claim that we assent to them. And now the geese are made to share the sentiments of ourselves in the window, to think that something is wrong, that this little girl should be so vigorous, not only fighting against her own shadow, but fighting with her wand, with her rod, against the geese. And as if they feared that this could come to no good. And so I think twice there we have a metaphysical connotation, fighting against her shadow and causing the geese to remark how wrong this is to display so much energy and such tireless ambition with her slight strength. Now, all my poems end inconclusively, and I used to be taken to task by members of my group for that, and I didn't know any defense, but my defense nowadays, you see, after being taken to task a long time, we think up some excuses. And I think that there is no defense against an inconclusive miracle, against a representation of an idea which cannot be presented to the senses. But nevertheless, the experiences had there, we get those metaphysical feelings about the thing, and the best we can do is to have them strongly, and at the end to put them aside reluctantly. It's a shame that this gentle little creature with her energy couldn't survive the storm, and that we now are vexed to see her lying this way, as if in a brown study from which she would never come out, lying so primly propped. So the resolution is, of course, the great subject of poetry, the most serious subject, is death. And there's no recourse from death, except that we learn to face it and to get on speaking terms with it, and then to have the characters who leave us and bereave us pass as magnificently as possible. And then life must go on. So in many poems of mine, I think I intended for a resolution of that sort to be apparent.
Well, John, what is the function of meter in this poem, would you say, or in general? Is it a measure? What is it? What does it measure? What do you count? How is the measure made?
As I understand it, and I concede in a moment that it simplifies the thing, but I'm using now the old tradition of meter. The moderns have taken many liberties with meter, and they have found that poetry doesn't necessarily leave us when we abandon the strict meters, or when we abandon all the meters. We may still have a metaphysical poetry, but I would think the meters are very useful to us. And in the old and strict times, in the meters, we had all syllables valued two ways, stressed or unstressed. That is to say, more stressed or less stressed, more heavily stressed or more lightly stressed. And there was an agreement that a line would consist in a fixed number of feet, a foot being a stressed syllable with its share of the unstressed syllables to go with it. And that a stanza would be an arrangement of lines which was uniform from one stanza to the other. And so I have here a stanza of four lines. The last one has only 2 feet with or 3 feet, or perhaps 2 feet in the first one, and after that 3 feet. But the first three lines all have 4 feet, that is, they're four stressed syllables. But unfortunately, because it might have been otherwise, so no poet would admit that he had done the thing wrong if it finally became about as good as he could make it. Every time I reprint my poems, I tinker with them, and especially towards tightening up the meters. But I never wanted to tinker with this one, although there's a question whether there shall be one unstressed syllable going with one stressed syllable to make a foot, or sometimes two unstressed syllables going with a stressed syllable to make the foot. There's a little variance here. And I would call it perhaps accentual meter. That is to say, we just count the number of accented or stressed syllables in the foot, in the line, and let the unstressed syllables take care of themselves. So that sometimes you get two stresses coming together, and sometimes you run over two or three, or maybe even four unstressed syllables at once, which was against the rule of the old poets, but moderns have done that a good deal. And I would imagine as to what use that is, a good deal of musical regularity comes into the poem. It's to construe the music of poetry best, we would have to admit that it's a low grade of music, but the time signature is that part of it which is most important. And furthermore, that a stressed syllable denotes a high pitch and a loud tone, as well as, most likely, a little longer duration. And we should think of the way that the ballad measures, but regularly iambic for the most part, that is, counting the unstresses as well as the stresses, the ballad measures of the tune writers, such as Watts and Wesley, and sometimes even greater poets, have been put to music, would show that where you have a stressed syllable, they have, a half note, and where you have an unstressed syllable, they have a quarter note. Where you have two unstressed syllables going with the stressed syllable, they'll have two eighth notes, and so on. And there's a tendency for the long or stressed syllables to be higher in pitch, to stop on critical places in the musical system. But they did that admirably, and they never destroyed the meter of the poem by converting it into the score of music with a time signature. And I would say that if you let me read over some syllables, I can very easily read for the meters without any regard for the prose sense. There was such speed in her little body, and such lightness in her footfall, it is no wonder her brown steady astonishes us all. I think I'll make that astonishes us all, and then that will be three, like the last words of the other stanzas, and that'll be like many a hymn, which will have three four-beat lines followed by a four-beat line with only three note systems to fill them, a long hold on the last beat, so that it's a double beat. And I think I would read it that way. I think I would say such lightness in her footfall. I don't like to say footfall as if we could rhyme or fail to rhyme the last syllable, because that's a mooted thing. It's very, very exceptional if it occurs. And
may I interrupt, John? Previously you read that line as a 3-foot line, which puzzled me. I always thought of it as a 4.
It's a 4. I have been intimidated by the linguists, the people who are pushing the linguistic science, and so I've intimidated by their readings, which are invariably prose readings. But I conceive that a little quaint corruption of the strict prose accents, as the linguists would have it, the scientists of the prose language, doesn't hide a poem, because it's metaphysics anyway. And I should read that. "And such lightness in her footfall." I think I would prefer to read it that way. And if I had talked about meters before I read, I should have read it that way.
As a contest, then, between the prose reading and your metrical reading.
It doesn't hide a thing. It complicates our reception of a poem. I can't believe that a veteran reader lives who is unable to read a tolerably metrical poem without stopping when he finds a problem in the meter. He can't pass on. He stops to work that out and then to reread the line the right way before he can go on. So he's doing two things at a time.
The right way being his resolution of these two demands that are being simultaneously upon his attention.
Yes. I should like for the prose to concede a little. But then the meter is very powerful. It's the constant thing. 4 to a line, and many normal cases of perfect iambic feet. And it can afford many little concessions because it's running on forever. And now as for the use of that, I'm sort of usurping the conversation, I'm afraid.
No, fine. Go ahead. This is fine.
Well, I'll mention two uses. One is technical. I know it well in my small experience as a poet. I think most poets who've written meters know it well. The first version of the poet, of the poem that comes out, just drives us wild. We know we've got a poem there, but it's like an untamed tiger. We haven't got him firmly. We haven't got him by the right place, and we must do something about it. We must revise the poem. There's no way to revise a poem, and some young poets are without the capacity to do this, which would indicate that they lack something of the gift of being a poet, without taking the very same situation, shutting our eyes and submitting it again for the imagination to see what's there, so to see if better little aspects, little angles of that experience won't turn up. Well, now it's hopeless if you go out into the woods, say, and say, well, I'll rewrite this poem. You sit down and ponder, but the thing won't come back. And you don't know what you're looking for, really. But now suppose there are places where the meter is unsatisfactory. And they always are. The meter's too rough. Or sometimes it's too smooth and it's got to be roughened up in order to get that counterpoint. And so we are looking at it with a metrical consideration. Here are two words coming together which mustn't come together. Oh, here's a phrase of 4 words which doesn't make any meter at all, and the prose is so powerful in it that nothing would disturb it. And so we then think of verbal changes, and then verbal suggestions come in, or we think of rhymes, and then we can easily figure on other rhymes. And we may be sure that after we have tinkered with a poem to improve or perfect or establish its meters, that the thing we finally pick as our poem will not be merely metrically acceptable, but it will have a powerful imaginative quality. We're looking at it from all angles, so our attention is concentrated on finding the metrical feature.
How would you explain that, John? Is it that with the conscious mind given a problem to work with, a metrical problem, there is a further continuing release of the unconscious in some kind of profitable way?
I think so.
Let me hang on to this notion a little longer. You're thinking of meter and rhyme, such mechanical requirements of verse writing, as an asset to the poet then. This is distinguished from the function it might have for the reader. This is the poet's profit in the business.
Yes.
That it's a matter, it becomes a method then for him, a method to go more deeply into his subject, into himself in relation to the subject. Is that it? Something
yes,
of that sort?
Yes, that's very fine.
That it's a matter of a method of opening up the possibilities of association and suggestion then in the yes. situation that he is sitting in that moment trying to write poems. Is that
that's it? Yes.
I'm sure that's right. I'm sure it's a way of keeping your mind both asleep and awake so he can do some profitable work.
Well, isn't this the fact? I know that there are a great many highly metrical poets who weary us, but aren't there many free verse poets whose lines come out too thin? It's very hard for them to go back and recover the experience fresh and find something else to go on.
Well, I don't want to interrupt this profitable flow, but may I put in for the sake of the reader here, isn't just possibly one of the advantages, at least, of meter for him, that it too directs his attention in some kind of fruitful way so that he is not merely adjusting the meter and getting it right, but getting into the metaphysical depths of the poet too?
I think so, and particularly in view of this situation and such lightness in her footfall, or in her footfall. Now there's a chance to take that either way, and there's a real ambiguity, and often that's very fruitful. And in any case, it makes the reader much more alert to those delicacies of meaning and those possibilities of more than one meaning. I think it's bound to make him more alert, therefore more responsive to the words of the poet.
Let me nag at that line again, may I? Which has always been a rather haunting line for me, as the poem is a rather haunting poem for me. At one time I've even speculated about reading that line this way, resolving it metrically this way. I'll flatten it out as much as possible. And such lightness in her footfall. That is, almost a kind of, not a trochaic lightness, but almost raising the ness with some little quiver of the unprosed raising of that. Now, I take the reading you take, primarily, but this has always haunted me as a possible solution to this line. And the next thing...
I can see the intelligence of that.
That reading played against the reading you have given, which I've always settled on.
Yes.
But always the sense of this possibility and such lightness in her footfall. The strange wave of the line has, a kind of a shimmer of wind on water, because these other, more than one possibility of resolving the whole line. The second possibility always being there in my mind. That's hung around my mind for years.
Yes, I think that any prosodist would be a simpleton if he declined the assistance of other prosodists. And what you've said is very intelligent, and that would seem to me to be a fine way to read it.
Mr. Ransom, I wonder if you'll comment on a poem I have here by John Donne, one of his religious sonnets.
If poisonous minerals, and if that tree whose fruit through death on else immortal us? If lecherous goats, if serpents envious cannot be damned, alas, why should I be? Why should intent or reason born in me make sins else equal, in me more heinous. And mercy being easy and glorious to God, in his stern wrath why threatens he? But who am I that dare dispute with thee, O God? O, of thine only worthy blood, and my tears make a heavenly Lethean flood, and drown in it my sin's black memory, that thou remember them, some claim as debt. I think it mercy, if thou wilt forget. That's very, very close, strong stuff. That's a piece of composition that's tough from start to finish, with a trick that's typical of John Donne. He likes to put strong monosyllables together and invite you to put more stresses than the line will take. And it has the effect of a counterpointing that immensely enriches the substance of his lines. You could not read that in a hurry.
This heavy counterpointing and contortion, in a way, of the language, as opposed to the fluidity of another ideal of poetry, goes with the intellectual gravity or the intellectual difficulty of the handling of the subject. Is that what we are saying?
I think so. It seems suitable, because here is a case of a priest considering his own salvation and wondering why God has thrown upon him a responsibility that he hasn't thrown on any other creature. And finally, feeling inadequate, he hopes that God's mercy will be not in remembering his debts to forgive them, but in forgetting them. But it's a very close argument, and I think that possibly the whole rhetoric of it is in its closeness, or nearly all, that the language is fine. I mean, you say these are very important words. They refer to very substantial kind of experience, but they don't have to be so close as they are here. And
do you feel some, I don't want to put words into your mouth now, please, but do you feel some relation between this waiting and contorting of the language, this counterpointing which you referred to, and simply the, not merely the gravity of the subject, but the urgency of the subject that is felt, the felt urgency of the subject. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, I think, now isn't this your question, that it has twice as much gravity for being played, for those lines with their frequent accents, heavy accents, being played against the ideal meters of the poem.
I should agree with that completely, yes. That's the distortion I'm talking about, and the contortion I'm talking about. It is based on this the shadow of regular meter behind it.
Yes, that's a kind of counterpointing. I'm not a musician, but the kind that would have come in with Beethoven, say, rather than with Mozart.
May I interrupt to change to another poem? Here's a famous beauty, where something is being done with the official meter. It's Blake's Sunflower. Won't you read it and then talk about what counterpointing or other topic comes to mind?
Yes,
in relation to the
now,
verse.
This, of course,
meter and other things.
Is not rehearsed. His poem to the sunflower. Ah, sunflower, weary of time, who countest the steps of the sun, seeking after that sweet golden clime where the traveler's journey is done, where the youth pined away with desire, and the pale virgin shrouded in snow arise from their graves and aspire where my sunflower wishes to go. That's odd, because there you have a strictly ballad line, 3-foot lines with a heavy pause after each one, as heavy as we dare to give it. Being sophisticated, we won't give a full pause, but the music would have one. But the feet are not iambic, but they are anapestic.
Anapestic.
And that makes him run over some very strong words.
But like, it's a very slow anapest, though, isn't it?
Very slow anapest.
What makes that anapest slow, John? What's the cause of that retardation?
You can't afford to miss, for example, seeking after that sweet golden climb. You can't afford to hurry over golden. It's just as important as sweet.
The rhetoric, the meanings there, yes, constantly pulling at the meaning,
yes,
of the anapest.
And this one, and the pale virgin shrouded in snow. You can't possibly subordinate your virgin to pale and shrouded. And so that's very bold.
It's the rhetorical pull back against the anapestic movement.
Yes.
Is that the meaning pulling back against the anapest?
Yes.
Fairly often. Is that the notion?
I think so.
Well, it worked two ways. One, the meaning pulling back against the anapest will give it a special quality as meter, and vice versa, the meter pulling at the word through the anapest will put special stress on certain words and make you attend to them.
I think so. I think it may be that virgin, and we have remarked this meter, comes out stronger in its unaccented position than it would otherwise.
Very interesting point.
Could easily be.
Yes. We have to overcome our initial metrical impulse to subordinate and drive on to shroud then, don't we?
Yes.
So we set it up. It emerges more significant to us.
Well, I don't want to nag at a point that has been raised before too many times, but the last poem, and the Donne poem will indicate, John, why I keep hankering after wanting to tie these supreme metrical effects, or even just the highly interesting metrical effects, back into meaning in some sort of way, the way in which the meter, the metrical effects, are all important for emphasizing meaning, heightening meaning, teasing us between two meanings, and in return, have kindled in them a special music by the very pull of the meaning.
I notice that you did not say there that that the meters express the thing.
No,
Sometimes they do, but that's an entirely different case, a much weaker case than the one you have described.
Yes.
That's a different proposition, I think, and one that I except perhaps in the most marginal way, I could never accept it.
Yes.
I think I should say the same. There was a time in which I was much more convinced of the directly expressive power of meter than I am now.
That if meter were bent at absolutely going with the sense, so there was no counterparting between the prose stresses and the metrical stresses, it would get dreadfully monotonous, and we know poets who occasionally have let down into that kind of work.
John, I changed the subject abruptly, but I do want to ask this. How do you compose yourself? Do you have a tune in your head, as Yeats said he had?
I've had a different opening for each one, probably. I had no system. I say had. I don't know whether I'll write anymore or not. I never tried to write and found I couldn't. I just got involved in some of these theoretical questions, philosophical questions. They just engaged my whole mind. But studying poetry made me love poetry better than I knew how to do it from composing it. There's such a flashiness about the feel of your own composition that you really enjoy as the great poetry of the language which you are studying. And
well, you should have thought about other people's pleasure more then.
Well, thank you very much. But at any rate, I never had much of a ritual for writing poetry. I found, as I think I can recall this much, I would feel all fresh for writing, as poetry was stirring in me somewhere, and so I would knock off a poem. But the next morning I would read it, it wouldn't be so good, I'd toss it into the wastebasket. And that would happen for a week, and then the last time I'd say, well, this isn't a poem yet, but it's the makings of one, I'll keep that one. And then in another week, maybe I'd waked up this tension that you talk about. I'd waked up a tension in me which made my reason, my thinking for the argument, and my imagination for the sensibility more compatible with each other. They began to try to please each other. And then I found that I could knock off a pretty fair poem. And while I was still at that height, I might do three or four poems. Then I'd let down again and have to
wait. Would the meter be fairly regular in those early drafts, John? Or is that a fair question?
I would have to feel that they satisfied my ear, but I was determined not to use any mechanical rule on them.
Well, your poetry has a great variety and of metrical effect. It's a very rich poetry in that way, and it's a rhythmical effect, put it that way. It's great. It's very resonant without being bold, without being overweening. And I've often wondered what sort of approach you had. I've always meant to ask you, what sort of approach you had? Was it, is it revised that way, or you feel your rhythm always came with the poem?
They came with the poem.
Came with the poem.
Of course, I wrote a great many poor poems before I wrote any that I wanted to keep. But I didn't lay down any rules or theories at any point.
Red, you had some questions I think you wanted to put to John. We ought to get in.
There's one question I'd like to put just for the, you know, for the troops. It's this. I know that you, as most poets, don't approach poetry by having a metrical scheme in their head as they when they start. But this metrical development usually is literally a development of the process of thinking and feeling into the poem. But looking at it from the point of view of a person who never wants to write poetry but likes it, is curious about it, do you see any advantage, any value in the study of such things as metrics, and the little chores of scansion, in the analysis of the textual verse? What does it do for a person, if anything?
I think it's very valuable to such a person. I've had many students who knew nothing to say about poems, so they liked the poems, until they got hold of meters and the principle of counterpointing. Then they had an endless topic there. I wished to sometimes they would go on from there and find other topics, but they were so completely possessed with that topic. But I think it makes us receive a poem much more fully than we could do it otherwise, and is the makings of such a rich reception of a poem that we could talk endlessly about it.
You mean it's a way of looking at the poem itself, a new way of looking and feeling the poem that you are contemplating, that you don't read over it anymore. You see it, you grasp it more fully. Is that
the
idea?
It's the first time they've come close to the poem. They've stayed with it closely, got a very intimate sense of it. And that sense of it was intimate in more ways than merely counting the syllables for the meters. But I would think that as a principal of the teacher of poetry, and he has one of the most honorable offices I know and one of the most difficult, that it would be extremely valuable if he would consent to, especially when he's teaching the traditional poetry of the anthology, to go back and study the way that poets use their meters. And before long, knew that they were using their meters, as their readers knew that they were using their meters and what meters they had used, that will give him an opening for bringing poetry home to the boys right where they live.
You mean then that this would be the way into a sense of the overall question of poetic style, to give a kind of a device of contemplation of the poem which would enable the young reader, or the old reader for that matter, to grasp his poem more fully in its resonances and its implications?
And in terms of its total meaning.
I think so.
It's sort of a prayer wheel then for poetry.
Yes. Well, you must get a lot of ideas from a prayer wheel.